accession number 22635, rule 1.
And this is real one. Vi, could I ask you first of all about your background? This, of course, would be well before the war. And where you were born and where you were brought up, you know, your early childhood.
Well, I was born in London, but my parents went to America in November 1923 on board the Majestic, as they were keen to start life afresh after the First World War, which my father served in.
Did he? What was he in during the First War?
He was in the Somerset Light Infantry, and he was in the war all the way through, my mother has told me, but wasn't injured.
Did he speak much about it to you?
Well, I don't remember much about my father because once my parents got to America, shortly afterwards they separated and divorced. So I've never known. What I've learned about it has been from my mother.
So how old were you when you went to America?
Three, nearly four.
Do you have any memories of that going over?
Just one faint one. Because I had a doll, and the day we landed, the doll had acquired a bonnet. My mother had crocheted a silk bonnet for it.
So what was it like growing up in America? You know, this would have been an interesting time, wouldn't it, the interwar period. Whereabouts were you based?
It was all over the place, really. When we landed, the first place we went to live was Bridgeport, Connecticut. But that, I think, wasn't for very long. The next place I remember was living in Peekskill, New York, in a boarding school. And that also wasn't for very long. The next place I remember was New York City, and then a boarding school in just outside Philadelphia. And that is where we were when I think Lindbergh was flying across the Atlantic.
Do you remember anything about that?
Well, yes. We were told as children that after that journey he would be flying across to some gathering at City Hall, I think you call it, in Philadelphia, and that we could look out for his plane flying over and we would recognize it because it had only one wing. So we thought, well, we'd be sure to recognize it because we hadn't seen an airplane with a wing on one side only. So, of course, we never did recognise it.
That was quite a historic moment, though, wasn't it? Was there a lot of fuss made of it in America?
I wouldn't know because I was so young and didn't really have access to newspapers, but it was just the general talk that we did know about it. I remember knowing about it when we were told that a plane would probably fly over on the way to Philadelphia.
Yes, New York City, that must have been very interesting, you know, during the late 20s and 1930s. What are your memories of the city? You know, what was going on there at the time?
Well, my mother had married by 1928, I think, and she'd married again.
To an American?
In America. He was Scottish, so. And he pointed out the Woolworth Building as being the tallest building in the world, and he actually worked inside that. And I also remember going past the Chrysler Building when it was being built and seeing all the scaffolding around it. and told that that would be the next tallest building. And then the Empire State Building didn't take long to follow. And so that was the tallest for many years.
Did you see anything of the building of that as well?
No, so I wasn't living in New York at that time. I used to come up and stay with my parents for school holidays, because I was boarding in the country. My mother thought that was the best place for children.
This, of course, would be the Depression years, wouldn't it, in America?
1929 to 32.
And, of course, you would then be 9 years old, 1929. Yes. Sort of more aware. Did it impinge on your life at all when you look back?
Well, my mother was always a very generous person. And I remember seeing boxes of clothes that she wanted to give to help, and they were her nice clothes, you know, that she decided to part with. So it wasn't that they were not undesirable, they were really very nice.
Did it affect you at all, the Depression, you and your father and your stepfather and mother, apart from the fact, you know, of your mother's generosity?
I don't think so. It was just I've never felt the bad side of that now.
Were you aware of when President Roosevelt came to power?
Yes, I remember when he was elected. There was all sorts of searchlights flashing across the sky and crisscrossing and. So it was really quite momentous. I heard it on the radio, and it was very interesting. So in 1934, I went to visit my parents in Washington DC during the Easter holidays. And while out walking and exploring, suddenly there were these motorcycle outriders approaching, sirens blaring, and the car behind them it was an open car, and inside it was President Roosevelt and his wife Eleanor and two of their grandchildren, and they were on their way to church. And the church was just around the corner from where I saw them. So it was really very interesting, and something I'd never expected.
Well, was it known then, Vi, generally, that he was in a wheelchair?
No, I didn't know that. But I noticed when he was coming out of the church after the service that he took rather a long time. It was down a side street. So it wasn't easy to see.
You were obviously growing up, you know, as an American child, were you? Did you identify with America? You know, school, for instance, I understand there's quite a lot of patriotism. Is that right, in American schools?
Well, at school, in the beginning of the day, they usually started the day with pledging allegiance to the flag. And sometimes that was followed by singing America.
Did that make you feel American rather than British?
No, it was just something that happened every day. One day we were in the classroom and just happened to look out the window, because there was this humming noise. And what did we see going by? It was the Los Angeles, and it was fairly low because we were in the second story of the school building, and it was really quite low. But you could read the name Los Angeles on the Zeppelin itself. Years ago, I actually was taken by my mother to see the Los Angeles when it was on the ground in New Jersey. And I remember going into the Zeppelin and walking along a passage, and the compartments off the passageway had seats like couches, and they were bright blue velvet, it seemed. So it was really some experience that I've never forgotten.
Were they very big? Was the Zeppelin very big, you know, going into it? I wondered how it related when you go into sort of a jumbo jet today. Was it anything like the size?
It's hard, excuse me, it's hard to remember exactly how big it was, because when you're... excuse me. When you're small, things look bigger than they actually are. I found that out by going back to old haunts. However, it was quite memorable.
Yes, it sounds from what you're saying, the blue velvet, that it's quite plush, quite luxurious, was it?
Well, it was really beautiful.
So how long did you stay in America?
I stayed in America until September 1935, and I was just nearly 16.
I noticed, Vi, that you have a very English voice. Have you any idea how your accent changed during these years? Did you start speaking with an American sort of accent?
Well, I believe so. The way the words were pronounced is different from English. But it's gradually changed, I think. But I'm told I still retain some American sounds, but I'm not sure what it sounds like.
So coming back to England at the age of 15, you say?
Well, it's nearly 16.
Months off. So this would have been 1936?
It was 1935, September.
35. This was just for a short period, was it, Vi?
I was to stay with one of my mother's sisters who lived in Aberdeen for 2 years. But then I asked for an extra year because I thought I might not be coming back to this country when I returned to America. But when the war started in September 39, which was the time I should have gone back, I couldn't do that. So plans just weren't carried out.
But how did you travel to England when you came?
I came on the ship Laconia.
What was that like then, you know, to travel over the Atlantic in 1935? How long did it take?
I think it took about 10 days, and it landed in Liverpool. But the first sight of land I saw were the Liver buildings, and I thought they were very impressive. And my aunt and uncle were waiting on the dockside and gave me a great welcome, which was very nice.
And you then went to Aberdeen, did you?
We went to visit relatives in between, but it was only overnight, and then we went to Aberdeen by steam train.
So what was it like adapting to life in Scotland after America?
Well, I was used to living in other people's houses and boarding schools, so it wasn't something that was too strange. But it was interesting to note that where houses in America were centrally heated, they weren't in Aberdeen. The houses seemed to have one fire in a fireplace in the sitting room and not in the rest of the house. So that was decidedly chilly.
Was it also a different standard of living? You know, did you find that it differed from America?
Well, the American cars were bigger and the British ones were smaller, but the British ones were taxed by the engine capacity. And so smaller ones were less expensive to run. So that was sensible, I suppose. Mm.
And sort of food and consumer goods, was that very different from America?
Yes, there wasn't the same selection at all. And so types of food I found usual in America, they didn't have them in Scotland. Vincent, no corn on the cob.
So was it the case that you really would like to have returned to America?
Well, it was, I considered it at home, and I thought the world of my mother, so I was always very happy to be in her company.
Did you continue any education in Scotland?
I went to a business college, which is where I learned to do shorthand and bookkeeping and that type of thing. And I found that it served me very well in all sorts of the years since then.
What was Aberdeen like in those days, you know, the pre-war? It's now a big thriving oil town, isn't it? But what was it like at that time? Was there much sort of going on there? This is before the war started.
Yes, not that I've noticed, but it was... well, they had horse and carts, and these big shire horses pulling carts of different materials to the streets. And the fish market was thriving as well in those days.
Were you getting any sort of intimations of the coming war? You know, news from Europe, like the Spanish Civil War and what Hitler was getting up to. Were you sort of getting any political news of European affairs?
Well, I was always interested in what was happening elsewhere and locally. And remember in 1938 when Mr. Chamberlain came back with his declaration of peace in our time, and we still did go and get training, because I went and volunteered to do first aid, so I went to classes on first aid to do with the ARP.
And that was in Aberdeen, wasn't
it? That was in Aberdeen in 1938, but we were hopeful that war wasn't coming.
Do you remember the declaration of war and where you were?
Yes, I do. I was in my aunt's house listening to the radio and when war was declared.
Yes, I wonder how you felt, because, you know, being in England and so far away from, you know, as you were saying, America was still home to you.
Well, it was just, what happens now? That was the feeling and what we were thinking.
Were you working at that time?
I was working in the library, in the local library in Aberdeen.
And how did, you know, this period from the outbreak of war, September 39, to sort of May, June 1940, the phony war, did your situation change at all in that period?
Well,
Did you make efforts to get home to America? You know, was there any...
Well, I asked at the beginning, but without any hope of managing it. So just decided that I would stay with my aunt and in Aberdeen.
And did you stay at the library during that time?
Just till I joined the Wrens, which were...
What made you want to join the Wrens?
I thought it was a good idea after I thought about it and found out exactly what was involved.
Was it difficult? You know, did you volunteer?
Yes. Mm.
Could you tell me about that? You know, what the procedure would have been? This presumably was still in Aberdeen, is that right?
Yes. I did have an interview, and then I was asked if I would like to go ahead and join the Wrens. Mm. So I did.
How stringent was that interview? You know, did you have to take an exam or a test or anything?
No, they just talked to me and explained what was involved and wanted to know what I could offer as a way of helping. So this is where being a writer in an office would be of help.
So your role was going to be a writer in the Wrens, was it?
Yes, that's right. Yes. So that's looking after correspondence and office work to keep everything, you know, tidy.
So were you given any initial training?
No.
Nothing at all?
Nothing at all. So I had the training they needed.
How about uniform?
No uniform to start with.
The people who interviewed you, did they wear uniforms?
I think so, but I'm not sure. That's not something I can recall.
So how soon was it that you got your uniform and kit?
Well, I'm not sure how long it was. Maybe a month or 2 months, perhaps.
It's quite quick.
Yeah. It's just don't remember exactly the dates.
And your initial work, you know, were you as a sort of lone man, or were you with a group of writers?
No, I was by myself in the minesweeping office.
Oh, could you tell me about the minesweeping office? Whereabout this was situated?
Well, there was the Balmoral Hotel at the bottom of Market Street was where it started out, and it was just a room on the first floor.
And what was going on in the sort of minesweeping
Well,
business?
They had a fleet of minesweepers, and that was really the important part of it, to look after the ships and to organise the sweeps and before each convoy came up the coast, because they had to finish the sweep, which extended up the coast, 2 hours before the convoys reached Aberdeen.
And what were you actually doing by in the office?
Well, I remember I had to, they wanted me to write letters, and there were different messages that they wanted put on paper. It was really just general office work, anything that was necessary or needed to be done, I did it. And they were intrigued with shorthand and wanted to know more about how it was done, how I could read it back.
Were the people in the office naval? They would all be Royal Navy or volunteers, Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve.
Well, the port minesweeping officer was a naval officer, but he'd been retired and came back from retirement, and he was the only other one in the office. I had to look after the needs of office needs of two commanders from an office next door as well. that they were all very, very nice people. I think thought the world of them.
Did you get any idea of, you know, the success of the operations, the mine sweeping? Were they managing to clear the routes for the convoys going, coming in and
when,
out?
When they, this was with the Oropesa sweep, they went up and swept. And when they found a mine and they would sink it by rifle fire, then they came back and reported this to the minesweeping officer. And then that information went down to Resize, which was the head area.
And you would have had, I suppose, presumably, you'd be helping with the reports, were you?
Yes.
Do you remember any particular sort of incidents related to that work with the minesweeping, in the minesweeping office? So you were dealing with a lot of paperwork, were you, Vi?
Well, it was any letters, and they'd tell me what, so I'd write it in shorthand, and, how'd you do that?
So were there sort of changes in the technology? You know, I was thinking of wondering about magnetic mines, and whether that became a challenge.
Well, they bought two ships for that, and the one was the Lord Hood and the other the Lord Barham. They put magnets, they towed magnets behind it, but then they brought in the degaussing to round the ships. They put this core around the ship to stop the magnetic mines being attracted to the ships themselves. And so when they had to pass over these things, and then the towing the magnets at the back, if they hadn't been degaussed, they could have been blown up themselves, you see. And then when the acoustic mines came along, they had this hammer, and it was a very big thing stuck out in the front of the ship, and it was like a bell, and inside was this hammer banging away, and this exploded it in front of the ship this time. Because the engines of the ships activated these mines, you see. So that was another one. And we had an expert from Vernon was attached to the office, and he was there to give advice and solution problems. And he had helped to clear the mines, I think, in the Channel after World War One. And been awarded the Iron Cross for that work. And then in 1940, in February, that's before I was in the office, during minesweeping operations, two minesweepers were sunk after they were attacked by German aircraft. And they were the Fort Royal and the Robert Bowen. And two skippers in other ships, which are in this group sweeping, excuse me, were awarded DFCs. And so in my autograph book, I've got these signatures, you know. And then the PMSO became ill in June, July of 1940, and was replaced by the senior lieutenant commander, RN, of the minesweeping fleet. And he was eager to get back to sea and succeeded by the end of the year. When he came ashore, he had a picture of King and Queen.
So this sounds a very satisfying job.
Yes, it
yes. was. Were you content to stay there for the war, or did you want to do other things?
Well, I hadn't thought of moving on, because I felt very... glad to be part of it. And,
and were you sort of, while you were working in the minesweeping office, were you related in any way to a group of Wrens in Aberdeen? Were you sort of doing training and drill and that?
We must have had a bit of drilling, but because we went on a parade, more Weapons Week, and marched down Union Street with all the...